Welcome to this Touch Podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Respiratory. This podcast will cover the pathogenic pathways underlying type 2 asthma and identifying patients with this disease, as well as the mechanisms of action and clinical data for biologic therapies. Financial support for this medical education activity has been provided by educational grants from Sanofi and Regeneron. Hello, and welcome to this panel discussion, paving the way for optimal disease control in moderate to severe type 2 asthma. I'm Dr. Michael Wexler, professor of medicine and director of the National Jewish Cohen Family Asthma Institute in Denver, Colorado. Joining me today are Dr. Flavia Hoyt, an allergist at National Jewish Health in Denver, Colorado, and Dr. Roland Buhl at the University of Mainz in Germany. Welcome, everybody. Today, we'll be discussing how we can unravel the pathogenesis of type 2 asthma, identifying patients with type 2 asthma, including clinical and molecular considerations. And finally, we'll review biologics in moderate to severe type 2 asthma with both current and future perspectives. So let's get started. We'll start off by talking a little bit about unraveling the pathogenesis of type 2 asthma. Severe asthma is currently identified in terms of two different major components, two major endotypes or mechanisms of action. There's type 2 inflammation, which is brought forth by interleukin-4, interleukin-5, and interleukin-13, and is identified by the presence of blood or sputum eosinophils, increased levels of exhaled nitric oxide, and a prominence of allergic inflammation is identified by either allergy skin testing or increased levels of IgE. In order to identify patients with severe asthma with type 2 inflammation, one must utilize biomarker testing. And currently, the way we manage these patients with severe type 2 asthma is to add on tailored therapy on top of inhaled corticosteroids and long-acting beta agonists. In addition to type 2 inflammation, there's also non-type 2 inflammation that's often neutrophilic and is often brought forth not by allergies, but more so by irritants, smoke exposure, and viruses. Neutrophils act at the smooth muscle layer, and there can also be a mixed or posse granulocytic features as well. The way we manage patients with non-type 2 inflammation is a little bit more complex, and we need to use a combination of utilizing long-acting muscarinic agents, behavioral and lifestyle changes, antibiotics, and therapies like bronchial thermoplasty. So, what is type 2 inflammation? Well, type 2 inflammation usually is brought forth by allergens, pollutants, and other stimuli that act at the epithelial layer and stimulate the epithelial cells and dendritic cells to produce different alarmins. These are epithelial cytokines that include TSLP, thymic stromal lymphopoietin, IL-25, and IL-33. These epithelial cytokines can activate TH2 cells or T helper 2 cells, as well as ILC2 cells, innate lymphoid cells. T helper 2 cells produce IL-4, IL-5, and IL-13, whereas ILC2 cells predominantly produce IL-5 and IL-13. IL-5 works at the eosinophil level. It binds to the IL-5 receptor on eosinophils and activates eosinophils as well to produce their specific granular proteins, including eosinophilic cationic protein, major basic protein, and eosinophil-derived neurotoxin, which are all responsible for causing some degree of eosinophilic inflammation. IL-4 and IL-13 also play a role in eosinophil trafficking into the tissue. IL-13, that's produced by both TH2 cells and ILC2 cells, often acts at many different layers, but it includes production of mucus from goblet cells, production of exhaled nitric oxide, and also plays a role in airway hyperreactivity and smooth muscle contraction. IL-4 plays an important role in B cell activation and production of a variety of different cytokines, including production of different antibodies such as IgE. IgE acts on mast cells and, in the presence of different aeroallergens, causes the mast cell to degranulate and release a variety of different mediators, including leukotrienes and histamines, as well as other mediators. So you can see that the complexity of type 2 inflammation results in all the pathophysiology that results in asthma, including mucus production, airway hyperresponsiveness, and inflammation from both the eosinophils and mast cells. So let me ask my colleagues a few questions to discuss the pathophysiology of asthma. Roland, why is understanding the mechanism of asthma inflammation valuable in the clinic?
Well, the number one reason why we are very happy to understand this new concept is the availability of really striking new treatment options to better target, in particular, patients with severe type 2 inflammation by directly targeting the mediators you just mentioned, such as IL-13, IL-4, or IgE, or interleukin-5. This has completely changed the way we treat patients with severe disease and has led to a huge new approach how we can make a better use of these treatments to really control patients we could not control before or could even only control them with high doses of systemic corticosteroids.
So Flavia, how are some of these biologics used alongside inhaled corticosteroids or long-acting beta agonists?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the key is primarily because of their cost, they're usually used as add-on therapy. So, you know, many of our patients can use inhaler therapy and do fine, but we find that those patients who are on, you know, medium to high dose ICS with additional therapies such as LABA or LAMA therapy and are still not doing well, still having flares, still needing oral corticosteroids, those patients need something more. And, you know, once we find out, you know, phenotyping them, figuring out exactly, you know, which category do they fall into, that's when we can start thinking about these medications as add-on therapy.
So it sounds like one of our major goals is to identify what type of asthma does the patient have, and then use one of these targeted approaches to really treat in a specific manner the specific type of asthma that a patient has. So, Roland, what factors affect the choice of one biologic over another? How do you choose between them?
Type 2 inflammation, as you said, includes allergic asthma, includes eosinophilic asthma. And if one of these two features is dominant in a patient, this influences my choice of my first treatment approach. Let's say we have a patient, asthma started in childhood, clearly allergic. There's a clear correlation between exposure to an allergen and allergic symptoms. This would make me think, let's try an anti-allergic approach, so anti-IgE first. At the same time, let's say the asthma started in the third or fourth decade. There is a high number of eosinophils in blood. Maybe if you measure exhaled nitric NO in exhaled breath, this would make me think of a rather late onset eosinophilic asthma, and this would make me think of either IL-4/13, dupilumab, or one of the anti-IL-5 drugs.
So it sounds like you try to identify the dominant pathway, the dominant biomarkers that will lead you to trial out a specific therapy. Flavia, are there any other factors that you utilize in terms of trying one therapy over another? And do you consider other potential comorbidities, for instance, in your choice of specific biologics?
Yeah, absolutely. As Roland mentioned, I think, you know, it has more to do with just phenotyping based on labs. It's really clinically what translates into what is the driver in a particular patient. And then, of course, as you mentioned, comorbidities are important. So many of these biologics are approved not just for severe eosinophilic asthma or, you know, allergic asthma, but also for other comorbidities. For instance, omalizumab is approved, at least in the United States, for chronic idiopathic urticaria. We have dupilumab that's approved for atopic dermatitis, chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyposis. So if you have a patient that has, you know, more than one condition, then clearly treating both conditions or all three conditions with one biologic gives you more bang for your buck, and that's an important factor. And then lastly, you know, things like logistics. So if a medication is a self-administered medication and a patient doesn't feel that they can do it at home, then, you know, choosing another option that's in the clinic may be worthwhile. You know, things like cost and insurance approvals. you know, here in the United States that drives a lot of our prescribing practices is, you know, which medication is going to be affordable for the patient.
Great. So what we've discussed so far is that understanding the mechanisms of asthma inflammation is very valuable in the clinic and allows us to use precision medicine to help identify which therapy may be best for our patient. But it's clear that we need to really hone in and identify what the mechanism of action is in a specific patient and say, what type of asthma does this patient have? So let's move on and let's talk a little bit about identifying patients with type 2 asthma. What are some of the clinical and molecular considerations that we need to have when we think about type 2 inflammation or non-type 2 inflammation in our patients? So the Global Initiative for Asthma came up with some guidelines to help us identify which patients have type 2 asthma, which patients have type 2 inflammation. It's clear that we need to identify patients who are unresponsive to GINA-recommended controller therapy, inhaled corticosteroids, long-acting beta agonists, long-acting muscarinic agents. And then we need to ask, what type of asthma does this patient have? What type does the patient have type 2 inflammation? Now, there are different biomarkers that can help us identify these kinds of patients. Eosinophils in the blood or in the sputum, exhaled nitric oxide, and IgE. As we previously discussed, eosinophils are activated by IL-5 and are trafficked into the tissue by IL-4 and IL-13 as well. Exhaled nitric oxide is predominantly produced by IL-13 at the epithelial layer, and IgE is produced by mast cells stimulated by interleukin-4. So how can we utilize these biomarkers to help guide our therapy? Well, the current GINA guidelines say that if you've had exacerbations in the prior year and you meet any of the biomarker criteria, then you may be a candidate for a biologic therapy. The guidelines say that if you've got blood eosinophils greater than 300 cells, then you might be a candidate for anti-IL-5 therapy or anti-IL-5 receptor therapy. Now, there's also data that suggests that even patients with eosinophil counts as low as 150 or sputum eosinophil counts greater than 2% may respond to those therapies. In terms of anti-IgE therapy, there is really a clear indication that there's benefits in patients who have allergic asthma. So how do we identify those patients? Again, patients who've had exacerbations in the prior year and who have evidence of allergy sensitization, so either by skin prick testing or specific IgE, and who have a total serum IgE level and weight within the dosage range. In terms of anti-IL-4 therapy, patients who've had exacerbations in the prior year and have biomarker evidence of type 2 inflammation with either blood eosinophils greater than 150 cells or exhaled nitric oxide levels greater than 25 parts per billion are identified in the GINA guidelines as patients who may benefit from anti-IL-4 therapy. In addition, patients who are corticosteroid dependent may benefit from all of these, but currently the greatest data really support the utilization of anti-IL-4 therapy in those patients. So, tell me, Flavia, why is it so important to promptly identify what type of asthma a patient has? Why is it so important to identify patients with type 2 asthma in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for our milder patients, they may respond to an inhaled therapy, and you really don't need to know necessarily, you know, what drives their asthma. But I think once we're talking about our more moderate to severe patients, you want to know what we're targeting. It's going to lead to more comprehensive and targeted therapy if we understand whether they're type 2 or non-type 2. It'll help us understand, you know, why they may or may not be responding to therapy. And importantly, as Roland mentioned earlier, it'll help us guide that next step, right? So once they're not responding, it will help us decide which biologic may be best, where should we start in terms of, you know, add-on therapy.
Roland, can you review which biomarkers are the most appropriate to rapidly identify in terms of identifying patients with type 2 asthma? And when should they be assessed? Early on in the course or later in the course? Should we be asking these questions when patients are in the milder state?
I think we should at least do the core biomarkers, and they have been already mentioned. It's blood eosinophils, if available, sputum eosinophils, but I understand for many colleagues, this is something very complicated, then exhaled nitric oxide can be easily measured. And of course, you can do a skin prick test or you can identify specific IgE. So I think the three core biomarkers, they can be easily identified. And I would like to make one more important point. Flavia just said it's important to early identify these patients, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, we want to prevent their exposure to systemic corticosteroids, and we also want to prevent potentially life-threatening events that happen in particular in patients with severe disease. And this is why it's of vital importance to early identify patients with type 2 asthma. And I always do it by blood eosinophils. That's easy to measure. It's a part of every blood cell differential, so you get the information right away. You can measure exhaled nitric oxide within 2-3 minutes in your practice, whenever you want to. And as I said, it's easy to look for allergy. And these, in my opinion, these are the most important biomarkers that help us to choose the right biologic for the right patient.
So what about non-type 2 asthma? How do we identify those patients? Flavia?
Yeah, you know, right now we don't have the best biomarkers for non-type 2 asthma. And many times defining their phenotype is by lack of type 2 asthma biomarkers, rather. So if the ENO is low, if the eosinophils are low, if they don't have allergic sensitization, then now you're thinking more about the non-type 2 asthmatic. You know, certainly if you're able to collect sputum or, you know, do a bronchoscopy with bronchoalveolar lavage and biopsy, and now you see some of the other cell types like the neutrophils, or again, notably lack of eosinophils, then those patients are really the non-type 2 asthmatics.
And are there any other biomarkers that can that are emerging that may tell us in the future something more than eosinophils, IgE, and exhaled nitric oxide? Anything in the pipeline that we can look forward to that anybody has any sense of?
I think from a biochemical perspective, there is potentially more to come. However, they are not as easily measurable as the three biomarkers we just mentioned. So in my opinion, you mentioned TSLP, thymic lymphoprotein. We had some experience with periostin. Periostin did not live up to our expectations. So there may be more, but at the moment, I think the three biomarkers we mentioned, they have a proven significance in patients with severe disease.
Yeah, currently people are working on urinary bromotyrosine, dipeptidyl peptidase 4, and others. And we'll see if they can help us in the future guide our patients in terms of specific type 2 therapies or non-type 2 therapies as well. So we've talked a little bit about the complexity of pathophysiology. We've talked about biomarkers. Let's focus in now and talk about the specific biologics that we utilize in moderate to severe type 2 asthma, both the current therapies that we have, as well as some future perspectives. So where do the currently approved biologic therapies work? We've shown this cartoon schema before, and really it's important to recognize the three key cytokines, IL-4, IL-5, and IL-13, as well as a key antibody, IgE, are all currently targetable by utilizing specific monoclonal antibodies that target those specific targets. Now, where do these therapies work? Well, we've discussed how important IL-5 is in terms of eosinophil activation, eosinophil maturation, and eosinophil proliferation. If you can block IL-5 or its receptor, then you may have efficacy in terms of abrogating eosinophilic tissue inflammation in those patients. Which therapies do we have available? Well, mepolizumab is a monoclonal antibody that targets interleukin-5. It's administered subcutaneously on a monthly basis, and it binds to IL-5 and prevents binding of IL-5 to the IL-5 receptor on eosinophils. Rezlizumab is administered intravenously. It too binds IL-5 and also prevents IL-5 from binding to the IL-5 receptor. Benralizumab is a monoclonal antibody that targets the IL-5 receptor alpha. It both prevents IL-5 from binding to the IL-5 receptor by occupying the receptor space, but also results in antibody-dependent cell-mediated cytotoxicity by when benralizumab is bound to the IL-5 receptor, the immune system recognizes it as foreign and will end up killing off eosinophils. Dupilumab is a monoclonal antibody that targets IL-4 receptor alpha. This receptor, it results in binding of both interleukin 4 and interleukin 13. So by binding the IL-4 receptor alpha, you can prevent downstream effects of both IL-4 and 13, including IL-13 mediated nitric oxide production and mucus production, IL-4 mediated B cell production of different antibodies, including IgE and others. And it results in significant benefits in terms of improvement in lung function for all of these reasons. Lastly, omalizumab is a monoclonal antibody that was approved for administration in patients with allergic asthma back in 2003. It binds to IgE and prevents IgE from binding to the Fc epsilon receptor on mast cells. This prevents mast cell degranulation and activation in the presence of specific aeroallergens. All of these biologic therapies that have been approved for patients with severe type 2 asthma have demonstrated efficacy in terms of reducing exacerbations and improving lung function, and in most instances, in reducing corticosteroid dosing and exacerbations in patients who are on corticosteroids. These therapies are all being studied for other indications currently, and there are several studies with benralizumab, mepolizumab, dupilumab, as well as omalizumab in different patient populations. Ongoing studies are evaluating the efficacy of these therapies in terms of reducing oral corticosteroids in patients receiving ICS and LABA, patients on oral corticosteroids. There are long-term safety studies with all of these therapies, and there are studies in children ages 6 to 11 or 7 to 12, and in specific populations, including evaluating these therapies in patients around the world, including in a Chinese cohort. There's also studies looking at the underlying mechanism of disease to evaluate the efficacy of these therapies in terms of suppressing airway hyperresponsiveness. And there are bronchoscopy studies evaluating the efficacy of these therapies in terms of suppressing some of the tissue inflammation that's ongoing. Lastly, long-term safety studies are evaluating the efficacy and safety of these therapies across a number of different patient populations in the real world and over lengthy periods of time, longer than what was seen in the initial phase 3 studies. In terms of other biologic therapies, there are several therapies that are emerging for type 2 asthma. These include therapies that block the alarmins, TSLP, IL-25, and IL-33. Most notably, tezepelumab blocks TSLP and therefore prevents downstream production of IL-4, IL-5, and 13. And it's currently being evaluated in phase 3 studies. It's shown in phase 2 studies to demonstrate efficacy in both type 2 as well as non-type 2 asthma. And so that's exciting for our patients. IL-33 has also been studied. It's another alarmin that data are emerging suggesting that it may also have efficacy in patients with type 2 asthma and potentially in non-type 2 asthma. So these therapies are all being studied, and I think they're really providing a lot of excitement for management of our patients in the future. We're going to have not only specific therapies that target specific cytokines, but also upstream therapies that can affect molecular targeting more broadly. So let's discuss this as a group. What's been the current impact or the impact of current and emerging biologics on the treatment of type 2 asthma? Flavio, what have been some of the benefits that you've seen in your clinic in terms of the benefit of some of these biologics?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, these biologics have made our practice better and easier in many ways for our severe patients. And, you know, just to think in 6 years, we've gone from one biologic agent to 5 different options, which is just so wonderful and so empowering. I mean, I think if a patient's doing well on you know, a biologic agent, then leaving them on that agent, you spare them oral corticosteroids, you spare them hospitalizations. You know, as Roland mentioned earlier, some of those hospitalizations and exacerbations can be life-threatening. And so really the impact has been immense and has improved their quality of life, has improved lung function in many cases, and has really improved the control of asthma and decreased the amount of oral corticosteroids we've needed to use in these patients.
So Roland, how do you integrate these biologics, the emerging biologics, into your clinical practice to maximize outcome for patients? Which patients do you start off with? How do you go back and forth with different patients with type 2 asthma?
Let's be provocative. I think my target now is no longer to put more drugs into more lungs to control my patients, but rather to put the right drug into the right lung. And I think this is the theory behind treatment of patients with CV disease. You have to make sure that you get the right biologic, and this biologic in many cases prevents patients from needing more and more inhaled and systemic corticosteroids. They prevent them from having exacerbations. And this is why, in my opinion, the earlier you identify the proper type 2 patients, the earlier you can start treating a patient with a biologic. There is one caveat, however, and I always point it out, not every biologic works in every patient. This is why after 4 to 6 months, we re-evaluate treatment response. And then it may be necessary, this is not many, but a handful of patients, you have to switch from drug A to drug B to maximize treatment outcome in these patients.
And so, Flavio, what do you do if one of your patients isn't responding to a current therapy?
Yeah, I usually rewind and I take it back to the beginning, which is to, you know, assess adherence, assess technique, making sure there are no comorbidities. You know, sometimes a patient is doing very well and then one of their comorbidities acts up again, whether it's reflux or, you know, sinusitis, and ignoring that and just, you know, focusing on the asthma and switching to a different biologic would be doing them a disservice. So I take a step back, make sure this is really, truly severe asthma that's poorly controlled. And then I try phenotyping them again or endotyping them and getting a sense, you know, is there another path I can take where I'm still, you know, using very targeted therapy for that specific patient? And I'm not afraid to switch the biologics. I've seen this work, you know, many times where you move from one to another and either they do well all of a sudden or they do better. And if they don't do well, we just switch back. So it's not, you know, it's not an end all be all at that point.
So Roland, what are some of the unmet needs for patients with type 2 asthma? You know, we've discussed all the benefits of the biologic therapies. We've discussed how they work and which patients they work. What are some of the unmet needs still that remain in your patients with type 2 asthma?
Yeah, I think the next frontier, and number one, we would like to probably phenotype exacerbations. We experience a huge impact of these new biologics on the frequency of exacerbations, yet there remain some patients continue to exacerbate, not at the very high frequency, but they still do. And what we don't understand is this just a non-perfect way of working of the drug, or is there a different type of exacerbation that still happens because the treatment is not able to control this type of exacerbation? And of course, we don't know about the real long-term impact. So nobody knows if after a couple of years, there may be even some disease-modifying effect. There's some preliminary data suggesting there is not, but I have not given up hope. So I think there's a lot more work to do, but overall, I'm very happy with these new approaches because they made my life much easier and they had a huge impact on asthma control in my patients.
Great. And lastly, Flavia, we've talked a lot about type 2 asthma, but what about all the patients with non-type 2 asthma? How do you approach those patients? What are some of the strategies you employ? How do you work them up? And what kind of treatment options do you have for the patients with non-type 2 severe asthma?
Yeah, so the initial steps are going to be the same, right? Checking adherence and inhaler technique and looking for comorbidities, phenotyping them. You know, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to use the same biomarkers because that's all we have right now. And then once I start, you know, finding out that they're that non-type 2, you know, I may be more inclined to use a long-acting anti-muscarinic agent earlier. I would refer to my pulmonary colleagues for evaluation of bronchial thermoplasty. And, you know, I think ultimately that's where, you know, targeting the alarmins, as you mentioned, you know, maybe may give us hope and may give us promise as an upstream target to look at that might block both the eosinophilic inflammation, allergic inflammation, and also this neutrophilic or non-type 2 inflammation. So, you know, that's where I'm looking forward to.
Great. So thank you so much to my colleagues today for joining us today in this panel discussion. What we've discussed today is that asthma, and particularly severe asthma, is a complicated entity that involves a whole host of inflammatory mechanisms and pathways that can be very challenging to manage. But we're in an exciting era now in which we now have options. We have to identify what type of asthma does our patient have, And we then can utilize specific targeted approaches to target our patients with type 2 asthma, identify those patients who have non-type 2 asthma, and hopefully in the future, we'll have other therapies that will be able to abrogate the inflammation that's going on in all types of asthma, so we can provide a precision-based approach to eliminate exacerbations, to improve lung function, and improve asthma quality of life in our patients. So thank you all for joining us today, and thank you to my colleagues once again for helping us in this engaging discussion.